Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. That's bam@Catholicism.org. I can also be found easily on Twitter @Brother_Andre and on Facebook. Tonight's show is on passing on tradition. And my guest in the second segment will be St. Benedict Center's own Sister Maria Filomena, the director of the St. Augustine Institute of Wisdom. A couple of years ago, I wrote an article that I called Traditionalism is an Affirmation. And this article was posted on the Catholicism.org website. You'll see it linked from the show details page on Reconquest.net concerning this show. This article got picked up by a couple of other sources. It was republished on the Rerate Celi website, and it was also republished in a UK-based journal called Christian Order. And because I said what I said there fairly compactly, and I don't know that I could talk about it extemporaneously, what I'm going to do in this show, first segment anyway, is read to you that article with a few little side comments here and there. One of the most important things for a person to have is an identity. This is why names are so important to us. Adam was given the power to name things in the Garden of Eden, showing that he had dominion over the rest of creation, including Eve, whom he named. When a child finds out that a large, strange-looking animal has a name, he finds comfort in the fact, knowing that if it has a name, and if mommy and daddy can identify it, the thing must not be all that terrifying. It is known. Traditional Catholics or traditionalists name themselves this way because of their embrace of the traditions of the Church. That is, they do so in the face of large-scale abandonment of those traditions by the hierarchy, the lower clergy, and the faithful alike, is why the name Catholic is not always adequate, though it should be. Beyond that very generic concept of what traditionalism is, there are manifold and disparate understandings of what exactly defines the identity of the traditionalist. Avoiding rigid dogmatism where the Church has given us no dogmatic definitions, we must be willing to die for Catholic dogma, but not for our own opinions. I would like to consider what traditionalism is in its essence. Contrast clarifies the mind, so I will begin with what traditionalism is not. Traditionalism is not a negation. It is not a denial. It is not a finger-pointing followed by a you're wrong. There is a name for that ideology, Protestantism. Protestantism is not a content, but an anti-content. It is not an affirmation, but a negation. Certainly, the Catholic must assent to the Church's condemnations as well as to her definitions. But a condemnation's existence is contingent on two things. First, the truth that came, and then an error that denies the truth. In other words, a condemnation, though good and necessary, only arises because some villain, perhaps Satan himself, concocted a denial of God's truth. But God's truth came first, and that's the important thing. The text of the Council of Trent provides us with an illustration of this. Trent affirms Catholic truth in its decrees, which are comparatively lengthy texts that explain Catholic doctrine in detail. At the end of those content-rich decrees, the Council then condemns various errors in brief canons. So the short answer to the question concerning a traditionalist identity is that he is a Catholic who affirms the dogmatic truths, moral teachings, and liturgical traditions of the Church. This is substantial and primary. That he does so in the face of opposition, not only from the world, but from others calling themselves Catholic, is secondary and accidental. Let us not invert that order, lest we allow the enemy to dictate our identity to us. And in a real sense, we become reactionaries rather than those who are essentially positively affirming something. A word about the quest for an identity. I believe that This is a very modern phenomenon, a product of the rootlessness of modern culture, which severs us from our traditions, our land, and our people. Modernity homogenizes us all, effectively uprooting local custom and cultures. The Catholic is a member of the universal church, but he is not thereby a citizen of the universe. He is localized, and his encounter with the faith is in the context of place, language, and custom. A Catholic from 14th century France and his co-religionist from 4th century Egypt possessed the same faith, morals, and religion, with priests, bishops, mass, sacraments, etc. But the variety of language, ritual, and custom was great. We can call this enculturation. It's not a totally bad word. The word can be used rightly. The faith is encultured in as much as it is incarnated in a specific culture. That is, as it should be, that there be these differences. We receive the faith locally. We live it in our families. We utter it in our tongues. We practice it in this church building with people from this community. I think of the Italian notion of campanilismo and the Carlist conception of fueros, which are political and cultural expressions of this. The campanilismo means the spirit of the bell tower. It's the feeling, it's the sense of belonging that Italians have when they hear the bell tower from the parish where they grew up. Because when you're in that parish, you can hear that bell tower basically to the bounds of the parish. You have a sense of belonging. It's your place. That there's a certain comfort, consolation that comes from hearing those particular bells. And that spirit of the bell tower is the spirit of that place, that locality, as it is kind of dictated literally by the sound of the bell tower, which is, after all, in the church, the very center of the cultural, religious life of the people there. So that's a very important concept. It illustrates something about Catholic culture. Also, fueros, we talked about with Dr. Wilhelmsen when we spoke of the Carlist traditionalist idea of politics. It's simply a particular Spanish embodiment of what we would call the principle of subsidiarity or local rule, something analogous to what we call in the American context states' rights, but it embraces a bit more than that. Again, it focuses on the local, the sort of the organic, and the natural structure of society based primarily upon the family and then on more local society, not this large, gigantic nation state, which is completely amalgamated and homogenized, where we lose our identity very easily in the abstraction of the national patriotism. So these two concepts, campanilismo and fueros, very much illustrate the concept of locality that I'm talking about. The living out of the faith is what produces a Catholic culture, and that culture is what ought to impress itself on our young, forming their convictions, eliciting their actions, commanding their reactions. An identity, a genuine one anyway, is forged in this organic fashion. We don't put them on and take them off like clothing or like an indecisive college student does his major. That is what the rootless, restless, modern man does, and this is one cause of his insanity. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. I'm your host, Brother Andre Marie, and we are talking about passing on tradition this evening. In our day, of course, the faith is not being lived in places where it used to be. The Italian bell towers that give those in their hearing the sense of home still toll, but they often herald the offering of a bizarre liturgy, the preaching of a watered-down doctrine, and the religiosity of conformity to the standards of this world. So campanilismo, the spirit of the bell tower, does not fully represent what it once did. The same is true elsewhere in the universal church. Thus it is that traditionalists travel, sometimes great distances, for a traditional mass, with the catechesis and the culture that also go with it. But we can still do very much to live the faith in our families and in our communities. In so doing, We must resist the temptation to make traditionalism into an ideology, a reaction, or a negation of what other people do. Traditionalism is what we are, what we know, what we do. Here, then, I will catalog some of the things traditionalists affirm, or what we ought to affirm. And by the way, this is not intended to be complete. We affirm the Catholic Credo in all its integrity. We affirm that the Catholic Church is the one bride of Christ, and that its faith and its religion are the only divinely revealed ways to believe in and serve the living God. Consequently, the Catholic Church is the only path to salvation. We affirm that divine truth is assailed by enemies of God's Church, and that the faithful must contend earnestly for the faith once delivered to the saints, to quote St. Jude from verse 3 of his one chapter epistle. We affirm the supernatural constitution of the Church, the natural hierarchy of the family, and the rule of Christ the King in society. To what degree we can, we will work to preserve or restore these things in our own families and our own communities. For the world, the flesh, and the devil are undermining this order established by God. We affirm that the Church's public worship of God, her liturgy, has been handed down to us with great care by our fathers in the faith. This has been done in a beautiful variety of rites in the East and the West. It is wrong to cast off these treasures of centuries of careful development under the protection of the Holy Ghost. Therefore, we will practice them, honor them, love them, and teach them to our children, these sacred rites, these sacred traditional rites of the Holy Church, be they Western rites like the traditional Latin Mass, or the beautiful and very different rites of the Eastern churches. The authentic response to evil, continuing with our list of affirmations here, the authentic response to evil is a life of Christian virtue and holiness. Very important. Let's not be the angry traditionalist who just rants that things aren't like they were before Vatican II. That is not, as they say now, helpful. So the authentic response to evil is a life of Christian virtue and holiness, which is none other than the faithful response to one's primary vocation, that is, the common call, the common baptismal call to sanctity, lived according to the mode of our secondary vocation, that is, whether we be priests, religious, married folk, or single people living in the world. So we live out our primary vocation to holiness, our baptismal call. We live that out in our secondary vocation, that is, those other states in life. There is much that is dark and evil in life, but if we choose to allow ourselves to be consumed by it, then shame on us. St. Paul notes that what we lost in Adam is far exceeded by what we gained in Christ. This is in chapter 5 of Romans. One need not have faith to see wickedness and despair. They are too evident to the senses. Recall that the pagan world was a very despairing world. The gospel brought us light and brought us hope. There is the real marvel is the amount of good that actually exists and that does take faith to see. Water regenerating sinners as God's children and heirs to heaven. God himself coming down on our altars in the appearances of bread and wine. The gospel being preached to the poor. And that gospel itself, the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, it is the good news. Good because it comes from the good God, and news because it needs to be told. We have a treasure in the Church's traditional liturgy. We also have great commentaries on it, none better than Dom Guéranger's liturgical year. By the way, St. Thérèse of Lisieux said that she owes what sanctity she has to the fact that when she was a child, the family read from Dom Guéranger's liturgical year every night. And this is what gave her something of a Catholic sense, a sense of the liturgy. By the way, you can buy that, that whole set, it's a 14-volume set, at store.catholicism.org. But whether you buy it from our store or not, it's a great thing to read, to pass on a love of the traditional liturgy and all of the Church's traditions that go with it. It's not just about the liturgy. It's a veritable library of Catholic wisdom, We also have Holy Scripture, the writings of the fathers and doctors of the Church, and great intellectual and artistic monuments of Catholic culture that were born of Christian societies. All that we have, plus God Himself, the angels, the saints, and a promise of future glory if we persevere. And let us not forget that we have Our Lady, whom we call the cause of all our joy. If, with all that, we need to go in search of an identity or define in purely negative terms against some other class of people what we are, then we really have no clue what tradition is. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. I am your host, Brother Andre Marie. When we come back after the break, we'll be joined by my guest, Sister Maria Filomena. Please keep listening.
You're listening to Reconquest with Brother Andre Marie, seeking that which was lost and fighting for it, exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome back to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. I'm Brother Andre Marie, coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. I'm on Twitter, @Brother_Andre, and I'm easily found on Facebook. Tonight we're talking about passing on tradition. Joining me now in studio is our very own Sister Maria Filomena, the director of the St. Augustine Institute of Wisdom. Good evening, Sister.
Good evening, Brother.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Sister, in this whole question of passing on tradition that you just heard me talk about for, 20 minutes or something, there's a lot of theory, and I talked about that theory in my first segment. But the day-to-day task of passing on tradition and passing on faith really involves practical things that we do, doesn't it?
No, it certainly does. And as you were talking, I was realizing that as every area of the world has developed its own traditions, so the methods of passing those traditions on vary too. But I think that there is a fundamental thread to how that is passed on. And you mentioned it, basically it boils down to becoming a saint. If you become a saint, then your example will lead the way for others. Isn't that the foundation of everything that we're doing?
So what you're saying is that the most important element of passing on tradition is to set an example.
Yes, but actually, before we even go to example, first you have to have it yourself. And if you're cultivating a spiritual life, a union with God, the example flows from that union beautifully with a lot less effort. There's always effort involved. We're human beings. We have to develop virtue. But it becomes rooted then.
So in other words, it's real. It's not just acting.
Correct.
You're not just sitting there saying, okay, well, how do I impress my kids by my virtue? So I have to act like a virtuous person, or I have to fake it, or look at pictures of saints and strike the same poses that they do. I have to have Saint Gerard Majella's, weak neck instead of my chin stuck in my chest, and that must be humility, right?
Right. I've heard that in working on virtue, because they're good acts, sometimes we have to act. Sometimes we have to do what we don't feel like doing to develop that habit. So there is an acting involved. But if it's not rooted and you're doing it because of love of God and love of your family and your friends and it's superficial and it will have no benefit. But that being said, once it's rooted, I don't see how, you can teach, you can say everything you want. I've certainly taught many classes myself. If what you say doesn't resonate by your example, then it's not going to bear fruit. So I guess your example will only bear fruit if you're growing in holiness, And what you say will only bear fruit if your example lives up to it.
You and I have both been using the word kind of over and over again, rooted. And we have a mutual friend, Dr. Robert Hickson, who's always talking about modern man being rootless and restless. And we need to be rooted in truth and in virtue. And even it rooted in our place, so that we have stable families, we're not moving hither and yon and all that. And we also need to be rooted in a sense of our identity, have a certain confidence, and we need to be restful, which is not to say lazy or slothful, but content, calm in our convictions. Whereas the modern man is always agitated because he never knows what his convictions are. He's constantly changing them. What can you say about how to become rooted? Mm. How is it that you become a rooted person?
Well, about rootedness, it's a metaphor from nature, as our Lord used in his parables so many times. But the idea of if you think of a tree growing, there is, in general, more under the ground than there is above the ground.
Mm.
And so a good example is what we see. And if it doesn't have strong roots, okay, so your question was how do we gain those roots? Well, like anything else, the last time you interviewed me, we talked about that quote from Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, that first you must become a reservoir before you can become an aqueduct.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to know tradition in order to pass it on. And in our generation, so often, especially of parents, but this would apply to any state of life. So often there's been a generation or two of a gap or three, and we haven't seen tradition lived, and we're trying to recreate it. Oftentimes from books,
mm-hmm.
or pictures,
and there's something kind of artificial about that. I mean, and it's not to say we shouldn't undertake it. I mean, it's the case with many of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say we shouldn't undertake it, but there is something kind of artificial about that. Saying, "Oh, I'm gonna do tradition." Well, tradition is something that's handed on to you. And if you didn't have it handed on in the sort of that organic way, there is going to be something that feels a little fake about it, right?
I certainly think so. But if it's not handed down to you, you have to do something to learn it. And so that's where the studies come in. This was something my mother was really, really good at. She read extensively and was always pulling in customs and books for us to read and things but especially customs and little traditions that she would work into family life to give us that sense of rootedness, even though it hadn't been necessarily been given to her. I can think of all kinds of, especially Advent's an easy one to come up with, but all kinds of different customs from different lands and different Catholic traditions with saints or preparing for the coming of our Lord in Lent, we always made pretty strict Lents. And we learned as children how glorious Easter could be when you had made a good Lent.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it was something I can praise my mother for, that she did store up this whole, she made herself a reservoir of all these different traditions that she could then turn around and pass on to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing my siblings then, of course, doing that in their own family.
When we talk about the artificialness, you know, of acquiring a tradition that wasn't organically passed on to you, that there's certainly an analogy of that in the religious life, because none of us were hatched in a monastery or a convent. At least I wasn't. Therefore, we come into this way of life that's radically different than what any of us grew up. Even if we grew up in a really good, happy, traditional home where the faith was lived and you know, dynamically and so forth, you enter religious life, you enter the convent or the monastery, and things are going to be really, really different. And you're going to have to acquire a whole new set of habits. You're going to have to acquire a whole new set of customs. You have to get acclimated to the voice of the bell, to the obedience to the superior, to the type of table culture that goes on in a monastery or convent, as the case may be. And so it's not impossible, right? We did it, right? I mean,
yes, and that shift, depending on each family's background, as you mentioned, that shift to religious life can be very, very great. But it's also a sign of humility and docility, important virtues that mm-hmm. you recognize that, okay, you're joining a new family and they're going to have their own traditions, that mm-hmm. new family, in this case, being religious life. Yeah.
So. Well, what I'm saying is by an analogy to the fact that, okay, so say you got our listeners out there and included in our vast hordes of listeners who are hearing us right now are people who are maybe young couples, maybe couples that aren't so young, and they are trying to bring up their children in a more traditional way. They're trying to live out the faith in a very dynamic way. That's on one hand, it's countercultural, but on the other hand, they don't want their kids to think that they're freaky Amish or something that are going to be despised by everybody else just because they wear weird clothes or whatever. There is a way that Catholics can that these parents can shift gears and say, okay, we're going to do things differently now, and they're going to have to acquire new habits. They're going to have to acquire new customs, and although the thread of tradition was sort of broken in so many places, they can still do it because yes. just as we could enter the religious life and sort of radically change the way that we were living, they even if we were living very, very good lives before, and I'm not mm-hmm. saying I was, by the way, but I went to LSU and I did some LSU things while I was there, but when you go to whether you've lived as a saint in a home, you're going to be living quite differently in a religious life.
Yes.
So you're going to have a radical shift, a radical change.
So a family can do that too.
Yeah. So a family can do that too, but you're going to have some serious commitment on the parts of parents.
Yes, and then everything ties together. So if the parents have, so say you have a couple that make the decision they want to be traditional and they want to raise their children in a Catholic environment, everything has to be weighed, there's a real focus on what is the end result,
mm-hmm.
Children, citizens for heaven, but what is the end result? And then everything plays a part in it. And so it doesn't have to be a negative. We're not going to do this. We're not going to do that. It's what things are you going to do? Of course, it's going to necessitate sacrifice, and you're going to end up giving up things. But the focus is less for happiness is less on I don't get to do this anymore than on here's all the things we're going to do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of parents. We realize when we come to try to live a more strict Catholic life, or I should say a Catholic life that's more in conformity with tradition,
mm-hmm.
that there are a lot of things that we're going to be sort of cut off from in the modern world. And I don't mean to say technology. I mean, here we are. We're using microphones and headphones and mixing boards and fancy computers and all this stuff in order to try to exercise our apostolate and spread the truth. But there is really a serious content of the modern culture that rather stinks, and it doesn't just stink, it stinks of
of high heaven.
Yeah, and it stinks of the sulfur of hell.
Yes,
and that needs to be avoided. But I think a lot of parents make a mistake in presenting these things to their children as, okay, here's a series of privations. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thrust of the piece that I read at the beginning in the first segment is basically, look, we're affirming truth. We're affirming goodness. We're affirming virtue. There should be joy. Hello. We're on our way to heaven. That's what we're trying to do. So there should be something joyful here.
Yeah.
And one of my pieces of advice to Catholic parents, not that they ask me a lot, but sometimes I get asked advice. But one of my pieces of advice to Catholic parents is make your home happy, which means you have to sacrifice. It doesn't mean that it's going to be all happiness for you and the wife all the time, but make your home happy. So that means you have to sacrifice things to make a joyful environment for children so that they don't associate the faith with sadness. They don't associate the faith with this sort of morose frowning and just a series of no, we don't do that. They need to have, yeah, we do this. We love this. You know, mm-hmm. Storytelling time with dad. You know, I was over at a Catholic couple's house, this huge family, lots of little kids. And it was story. We were their guests. And after dinner, dad says, okay, it's story time. And all the kids flocked around dad. And he started to tell this funny, absurd sort of fantasy story that he was improvising. And the incredible amount of love that burst out from the children in response to that was very edifying. And then, of course, all wound up in this is a life of prayer. You know, we were dinner guests that night, and they prayed before. We prayed before meals. We prayed after the meal. There, we said the Angelus together with them, and they have a family rosary every night. And the family rosary is part of a schedule that also includes storytelling time with dad, and the kids loved it. And they wanted to pray, and they wanted to be there acting out the crazy stories that dad made up, which were very, very funny. And it just showed me in living color in that the importance that, okay, this man represents God the Father to these children, and this woman represents the Blessed Mother to these children. And this man is teaching them right from wrong. But they love him. So yes. When they get it from him, when they get right and wrong from him, it's not just the stern disciplinarian who frowns and tells them what they can't do all the time.
Right.
It's a man that loves them.
Yeah. And parents have, it's such a, the older I get, the more appreciation that I have for parents and the sacrifices that they have to make. Because that father of the family who's worked hard all day could come home and say, you know, make the children be quiet. This is my time now. I'm going to go sit in front of the television and watch the evening news or whatever. But instead, he has to continue giving of himself when he gets home, mm-hmm. you know, to his wife and family. And so the sacrifice, I think Mr. Guzman mentioned this in his interview, that that every vocation, but the married state especially, requires tremendous amounts of sacrifice. One of my brothers, who's living in Alaska with his wife and five children, recently told my father that he is beginning to appreciate how much work is involved to make a happy home for children. It's not something you can just, oh, I've got the children now, I've done my job. The rearing of children, it's a great effort and sacrifice. And again, that goes back to what we said about example. The children are going to learn virtue and self-discipline from watching their parents. And so if they see their parents being selfless, they're going to learn it too.
And of course, that doesn't mean the parents tell them, look, we gave all this stuff up for you.
No.
they have to see it. It's got to be manifested to them. And it has to be associated with a smile, doesn't it?
Yes.
And the joyfulness that comes from real good, virtuous Catholic parenting,
mm-hmm.
even, you know, the joy amid sorrow. That's kind of the irony, but the secret weapon of the Christian life.
Yes.
There was something that crossed my mind when you were talking. You mentioned Sam Guzman's talking about sacrifice. And how he was talking about marriage,
mm-hmm.
and then about family life, that how important it is for each of the couple to sacrifice themselves for the other, especially for the husband,
right? To be selfless,
who's got to be selfless, got to set the example for selflessness, as Christ did for the church,
right?
But there's a book that I read on marriage years ago by Monsignor Charles Hugo Doyle. It's mm-hmm. called Cana is Forever. By the way, he has a book on the religious life called bitter waters. So mm-hmm. if you're deciding between religious life or marriage life, and you go by the titles of his books, you might, on the one hand, you think of Cana, you know, lots of wine, you know, good cheer and everything. And the other, it's bitter waters. Well,
every vocation has its ups and downs. So it's really what God wants you to do, not.
Yeah, but he's a brilliant author, and he had incredible, he was a confessor to nuns. And he had an incredible insights about the religious life, but also about married life. And in his book about married life, and I've read both, and I'm happy I'm religious, by the way, even though there are bitter waters. But what he says in his book on married life is that the number one enemy of married life, of family life, is selfishness.
Yeah.
And that this is the thing that will ruin a marriage, is when either of the couple are being selfish. And I was just today talking to a guy at the shoe store, of all places, where I went to go get some shoes, and his marriage just fell apart in 29 days. I asked him how married life's treating him, knowing that he just got married.
Oh, no.
His marriage fell apart in a month. And without going into detail, there was an obvious, clear-cut case of selfishness. That's why that passage from Father Doyle's book that I read something like 10 years ago came rushing to my mind today, because what he described to me of this woman's behavior was, oh my goodness, she was totally selfish. I had no concept of the kind of sacrifice it takes to live the married life. And she did something utterly deplorable. The marriage completely fell apart. Let's get back to this concept of passing on tradition, because we're talking about, I think you can say we're talking about an environment here, creating an environment in which is safe for the passing on of the faith.
Mm-hmm, which reminds me of that conference, I forget which year it was, 2009 maybe, which was all on culture, which was creating that environment.
Mm. Yes, and actually, I looked it up. It was 2009.
Okay.
And in that conference, you gave a talk with a ridiculously long title.
It was a contest between Dr. Hickson and myself who could come up with the longest title. I won.
you won that year. But in that conference talk, which, by the way, I'm linking it from the show details page of reconquest.net, in case people are interested. But in that talk, you gave a lot of practical pointers on what is culture. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because you gave a great little summary of how culture is an environment conducive to life.
Yeah, well, let's see. I was specifically relating, comparing culture to the basic three powers of man: growth, nutrition, and reproduction, and comparing that to the spiritual life, and then showing the importance of education and how the church has to meet people at whatever level they're at and raise them up. So I gave historical examples of different levels of culture and what kind of education the church engaged in at that time. I think that's would be better as a reference. I'm trying to think where you want me to go with that one, brother.
Well, go wherever you want to go with that, sister. The idea is we can think of culture like in the biological sense, you know, like a petri dish. You've got a culture. You've got something in there. Literally, they call it a culture.
Yes.
You've got an environment in there that's conducive to life. In the home, you want to create a culture, something that's conducive to life, not just obviously giving them three squares a day so that they don't starve to death.
Right.
But you want to have a culture in the home.
Yes. So, and that would include, as I mentioned before, everything ties in. So what is the family doing for prayer? What are they doing, you know, what are their work and their chores, and how, you know, what is the spirit in which those are done? What is their recreation? And is the recreation... let me get really concrete. If parents have a young family, you may want to seriously consider limiting the technology. It's been proven numerous studies how technology in, for young people really hampers their development, their mental development, their imaginative development.
Technology specifically?
I'm going to say screen time. So that would be movies, video games, those kinds of things specifically. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not saying, you know, cut the electricity to your home.
And mobile devices, yeah, right?
Right, right. Any way you can get that stuff. Because, and you might even consider going so far, here's where the sacrifice part comes in, as to limiting it for yourselves too as parents. I'm going to use an example from my family. When I was growing up, I remember my mother explaining why we didn't have television in the home to some neighbor, just saying that, you know, my husband, we talked about it and we decided that it was the best environment for our children not to have that distraction. And so my husband made that sacrifice. So he would listen to the news on the radio, but we didn't have a television in the home. And having seen many families and even my younger siblings when they did have a television to watch just movies, seeing the difference in the environment, this would be a recommendation I would strongly consider that you make, because the time that you might spend in front of a television, even if it's watching only good movies, and good movies are kind of hard to come by, especially over time, the standards tend to drop. There's so many things to be done, the books that can be read, the crafts that can be learned, the games that can be played. There's so much to do and really limited time in which to do it. Your children grow up very quickly, and to provide a solid foundation for them. So anyway, prayer, work, studies, whether you're sending the children to school or you're homeschooling them, however you're going about it, to be a part of the children's lives, and it's going to involve a huge amount of sacrifice. Another specific virtue that parents might want to consider is the virtue of modesty, which is related to temperance. And it's not immediately people hear modesty and they think clothing, but clothing is only a little tiny piece of it. St. Thomas talks about modesty as being regulating all of our externals. And some of the minor internals. But the way in which parents interact with each other, the way they talk to each other, the way they talk to their children. So manners, decorum, yeah, oh, anything external basically gets regulated by modesty. And this would be a virtue that would be well worth doing some further studying on.
When we had as our guest Charles Colomb talking about Blessed Karl von Habsburg, I was, in preparation for that show, I was reading about Emperor Karl, and I'd read the book by James and Joanna Bogle called A Heart for Europe.
That's a beautiful book.
And you see in the home, now of course, these were royals. These were royalty, and you could say, well, they were privileged. I mean, they had a lot of money and everything. But beyond that, they were, yeah, and of course, royals, they're privileged and they have the money, and therefore they can afford to be extremely decadent, okay? Emperor Charles chose not to. What I didn't say in that video, but in that audio, in that show, by the way, is that Emperor Charles' father died of syphilis. And there was lots of scandal in the family. One of the reasons that he became emperor was because it was very unlikely at the time of his birth that he would ever rule. Certainly not. It was very unlikely that he would ever rule as such a young man.
You mean Karl, right?
Karl is because one of the ones in the line ahead of him committed suicide. It was a double suicide or a suicide murder. He and his 17-year-old lover. He was a married man. So there was lots of scandal in the family. The Habsburgs weren't all saints. So Karl somehow got it right, even though his father was had issues. His father died with the sacraments, died apparently a pious death. I guess syphilis will drive you to seek the sacraments.
Yeah, but everything can come to good.
but for Karl, so it wasn't just that he was a child of privilege that he could afford to do this. What he did do, though, was create in his home a very happy home. He played with his children. He made sure he had time to play with his children. And this was a man who had serious duties, both as a young military man. He wasn't just a sinecure. He had a real job with the military. He actually fought in wars and so forth. And he really ruled as emperor. He was not a figurehead. He was not the king of England or the queen of England. He was not a figurehead. He actually had real power as a ruler. And it was not much more than a job, but
a major managerial position.
busy with this, yet he made sure to carve out time to be with his children. And he made sure to make time to pray as a family.
Yeah.
And they said including daily mass, by the way, which, yeah, they probably had in the home because they could have a priest who was their chaplain. But nonetheless, that would definitely entail sacrifice. They prayed the rosary. They had special devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. And there were certain prayers that they all said as a family. And Otto von Habsburg, Archduke Otto von Habsburg, who would have been the emperor had the empire not crashed, Otto von Habsburg was the one who, when that vicious bigot Ian Paisley started shouting down the Pope when the Pope addressed the UN, Ian Paisley marched in with this filthy sign and starts ranting against the Pope. Otto von Habsburg got up, grabbed the sign, threw it down, and started escorting Ian Paisley out of the General Assembly. My point in this is not just to tell a really fun story. My point in saying this is that something took. Otto has had Catholic convictions. And where did he get them? From his blessed father.
Yeah.
And from the Catholic culture in the home. So I wish that all of our royals had been that way. Maybe we wouldn't have lost the great Catholic monarchies of Europe had our royals taken their Catholic duties, their duties to God, more seriously. Well, sister, we have to wrap things up. The second segment's coming to a close quickly. Is there anything else that you'd like to say on this general subject? Giving one last practical tip on passing on tradition to the next generation.
Oh, well, I would just encourage, since we've been talking especially parents, I would encourage parents to realize the greatness of their vocation and their cooperation with God as creator and nurturer, to have a great devotion to the Trinity and to our Blessed Mother and her relationship within the Trinity, to each member of the Trinity, to realize the importance of their vocation and the greatness of it, and not to be afraid to ask for help in their vocation through prayer and from many sources and, you know, study and live the faith and do it joyfully. It's a constant learning process. It's not something you're going to be able to do in 5 minutes, but it's a wonderful experience to go through.
And you're going to mess up, so don't lose your cool.
Right, you're still a child.
Be humble about God's it.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you very much, sister, for being my guest. I appreciate it very much. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network. When we come back after the break, we'll have segment 3. Stay with us.
Your guide to the reconquest of what modern man has lost. Think of it as a roadmap to truth with a crucifix as a compass. Reconquest is exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network. I'm Brother Andre Marie, your host, coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. I'm on Twitter @Brother_Andre, and I'm easily found on Facebook. This is where we ask our question, what are you going to do about it? We're talking about passing on tradition. We're talking about traditionalism, that is commitment to tradition, as an affirmation, not fundamentally a negation. It's only secondarily a negation, but substantially and primarily it's an affirmation of what is true, what is good, and what is beautiful about the faith and the morals that we are given by God Himself through His Church. So what are you going to do about this? Well, you heard Sister Mia Filomena give a lot of practical pointers about family life and sort of cultivating, and the word is deliberately chosen, cultivating a culture in the home which is conducive to this, a culture being defined in one sense as an environment conducive to life. Catholic parents, what are you going to do to make your home an environment that's conducive to life, conducive to your children making good decisions about their own lives, about their own vocations. We need priests, we need religious, but we also need pious laymen. So you have to make an environment there. That's your challenge. Dads, your challenge is to be an image, a living image of God the Father, not just as judge and exactor of standards. That's there, yes. But especially as the loved one, the one who is benevolent, the one who will have the credit from them. They will give you credit as being an authority. And they'll only give you credit as an authority if they see that you love them only. We know that God loves us. And we know His majesty, we know His charity, we know His greatness, we know all these things. We're convinced, we should be, that he can lay down the law. But you've got to establish credibility. And it's not by arguing with them. You're going to establish credibility by making yourself the one that they love. And I'm not saying you do it in competition with your wife. Obviously, they have to love your wife too. But I see too many fathers that are deficient in this area, and they want to pass on the faith as if just dictating it is going to do it. You're not a dictator, Dad. You're a benevolent monarch. Meditate on the difference between those things. You're not a dictator. You're a benevolent monarch. And of course, you have to treat your queen like a queen in front of the children. And do things to enliven the culture of the home. Have real culture. Okay, you tell them don't listen to the grungy rock garbage. Don't listen to Miley Cyrus and all this junk, this wrecking ball nonsense. Listen to real music. That's the alternative. They don't even need to hear the name Miley Cyrus. They should be hearing good things, good music. And if you want to know good music, call me. Okay, call me, write me, email me, tweet me. I will give you loads of good music that you can listen to in the house. You've been listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. I'm Brother Andre Marie. God bless and Mary keep you.